On the other side of Texas, history has its place. On the other side of Texas, justice rules the case. They don't like it, they don't love it. They say we're all wrong, but on the other side of Texas halls, we roll on.
Hey there, howdy. Thanks for tuning in and telling friends that you hang out here on the other side of Texas. I'm your host, Jay West Texas Leeson, broadcasting from the Racer Car Wash Studios. Voted Lubbock's Best Wash for 5 years running. Stopping at one of five convenient locations across the Hub City for the best wash around. I'm kind of going junior league mom here. I'm putting a happy voice over some discontent. If I can grind with you for just a second. Earlier this week on Monday, go and see the accountant and find out what we're going to dole. What we're going to dole out. And it's not pretty at the Leeson Ponderosa. But a couple of weeks ago, get this. In what universe is this acceptable? In ours. That's a short answer. My mother is a home health care nurse, and she's a saint of a woman, and love her dearly. She's driving, pulls out from an intersection, and somebody's flying down the road to the north and completely takes off the front of her car. And they're going, well, I mean, you should see the skid marks go for like a block. No, somebody who's not going 40 miles per hour, definitely not 30 miles per hour, takes off the whole front end of her car. And it's a nice vehicle, couple of years old, and then the guy, by accounts of a witness, my saint of a mother, and another witness, the guy skids into a corner curb retaining wall, and then jumps out of his vehicle and starts running. And the cops find various, shall we say, paraphernalia in the vehicle. And all that to say, and this happened to me about a year and a half ago. I got T-boned on Avenue Q here in Lubbock coming home from the show. You get hit in a situation like that, and guess what? There is no sort of... It's almost like you were at fault. They gave mom a check that paid off the vehicle, and then she had to pay a $1,000 deductible on top of that, and then we're in new car phase right now. I mean, how is that acceptable? How in the world does mom... I know I'm being, rather than going on Facebook and sounding like a crazy man, I'm just sounding like a crazy man on the radio. But has to pay the $1,000 on the deductible. And then you're just in a situation where you got to put down a payment on a new vehicle. It doesn't make any sense to me. Something that does make sense to me, however, this helps calm me down a little bit. By the way, our guest today on the program, state representative, he's a chairman in the Texas House, Chris Patty. Been a long time coming before we got Chris Patty, who serves in rural East Texas, on the program. He's got a great bill up about rural jobs. Going to touch base with him, and then Wes Rappaport. Rappaport Reports coming in on the program as well. Wes will be with us in about 30 minutes from now. This from HoustonPublicMedia.org. Longtime listeners of the program know that we've had Barbara and Jim Miles on the program. They live in Leon County, and this is over in East Texas, and it has to do with the high-speed rail line that's going from Dallas to Houston. They came on the program, have put up a lawsuit against this, and here's the headline from Houston Public Media. Judge's ruling could have big implications for proposed high-speed rail line. We talk a lot about place on this show. A lot of people's place could just be gobbled up by this high-speed rail line. A new ruling by a Leon County judge could have major implications for the proposed high-speed rail between Houston and Dallas by preventing the rail line's developers from using eminent domain to acquire land for the project. For the past few years, Texas Central Railway has been working on plans to build a privately funded high-speed rail line between Houston and Dallas. An issue is whether Texas Central can use eminent domain as a railroad when landowners don't want to sell their land voluntarily. And I remember the Miles as this would go straight through their property. And I think this was like maybe a year ago we had them on, like last March, March or April. The company contends it has that authority under Texas law, but a Leon County judge has now ruled that Texas Central isn't actually a railroad. That ruling came in the case of a Leon County couple who sued. Quote, this company thought it could come in and roughshod over rural Texans without consequence, said Barbara Miles, who is as sharp a rural Texan woman as you've ever met, who sued Texas Central along with her husband, Jim Miles. What it vastly underestimated was the determination and the devotion with which we have prevailed against them at every turn. Speaking at a news conference, Miles's voice trembled with emotion. For us, it isn't just about dirt or rocks or trees or cattle or pasture land. It's about family. The lawsuit was handled by Blake Beckham, who said, quote, this project cannot be finished without eminent domain, and the project is completely off track. See what he did there? The project is stymied, and I don't believe it will ever be built. Former Grimes County Judge Ben Lehman, we'll just say Lehman, L-E-M-A-N, is also applauding the ruling. Lehman is now a state representative and said he's pushing for legislation to clarify who can use eminent domain. In no way, shape, or form should a private entity be able to falsely claim to have the power of eminent domain under the law that false pretense be able to terrorize and threaten hundreds, if not thousands, of landowners. Again, it goes from Houston to Dallas to Houston, from north to south. So maybe a little bit of justice there for rural landowners in Leon County, which is about, as I recall, halfway between Houston and Dallas. Glad to hear that. Makes me feel better and gets me in a little bit better mood given the day that we've had on injustice on another front. Who gets hit and then has to pay for it? Pay $1,000? It's crazy. Crazy. But that's what we live in. The man's against us here on the other side of Texas. But Chris Patty going to come in here in a couple of minutes and rescue us. Actually, some good solutions for rural problems. As we get in with Chris Patty, stay right where you are. Don't turn that dial. You want to hear from Chris Patty. If that's a new name for you, you're going to be glad to meet this guy. Coming up right here on the other side. Bottom line, you got a problem, go see these guys at Mullen, Horde, and Brown. His debut here on the program, he is Chairman, State Representative out of Marshall, Texas, and East Texas, Chris Patty, first elected 2013, currently the chairman of Energy Resources, Chris Patty. How are you, buddy?
I'm doing great. Is this DJ West Texas Leeson?
Man, I'm glad you're finally on the program. I don't know what's taking us so long.
I don't know either. I got to tell you, I was starting to kind of get my feelings hurt a little bit. I guess I was starting to think, well, gosh, I guess I've not done anything worthy of such a significant program as you have. And so I'm just, honestly, I'm just kind of speechless.
Well,
you know, honored. It just doesn't seem like that's sufficient enough.
I've gone from frustrated to somewhat jubilant back to blushing. I appreciate that. I appreciate that, Chairman. So here's something that really grinds my gears is we talk a lot about, and let me do an impression of Drew Darby, your peer there in the Texas House. Public school, independent school districts are the lifeblood of any community, any rural community, right? And we get into that a lot, and there are a lot of people who say, well, so school districts are supposed to be the main employers of a rural community or ag programs, and people begin to kind of hold their noses up at us on other sides of Texas and say, you know what, it's all government driven. And I think that's because so much of time and attention gets put on urban centers. And my big question is always, what legislation is out there? Because the urban centers certainly have good legislation. There's a reason why in urban centers bring in incentives, which here are called government. Whenever it comes to rural, it's government handouts, right? But whenever it's urban, it's incentives. But all of a sudden, here comes Chris Patty with an initiative to maybe not make public schools the lifeblood, maybe not make other things. Talk to us a little bit about your new bill, the Texas Rural and Opportunity Zone Jobs Act.
Well, first of all, I appreciate, Jay, the opportunity to talk about it. And you're right. I think so often those of us that grew up and love and wouldn't call any other place home but rural Texas, we know we have challenges. However, we have challenges to get our fair share of you name it, whether it's transportation dollars or education dollars or certainly economic development dollars. And so we started thinking in this respect as it relates to economic development, you know, what can we do to incentivize private sector capital to choose to invest in rural parts of Texas? So often when we talk about, you know, economic development, particularly at the state level, you know, it's all about the urban areas. And when you look at the various programs in the governor's office and otherwise, they largely are targeted to urban centers in Texas. Mm-hmm. And so we said, what can we do to incentivize, not look for, you know, a heavy-handed, you know, government picking winners and losers type thing that, you know, of course, is going to come with all sorts of red tape and everything else you can imagine. You know, what can we do to incentivize people to invest in rural parts of the state? And so we came up with the idea, and I'll be the first to admit that it's not an original idea, that there are a few other states that have done this in recent years. Most recently, Ohio is one. And so we're starting to see some results elsewhere. And so I'm perfectly happy to steal a good idea from someone else. So, you know, what we came up with is this particular program. And the gist of it is fairly simple. It's just, how can we facilitate access to capital, which is one of the major limiting factors for small businesses in rural areas to be able to create jobs, to be able to expand their businesses, to upgrade facilities, buy equipment, do workforce development, job training. All of those things are limited by capital. You know, our community banks, which are also a huge driver in our rural areas, they do a fine job, but they're limited in what they can do. They can only do so much, you know, based on that particular business and, you know, what their balance sheet looks like and cash flow and all of those sorts of things. And so, you know, we were looking, what can we do? So this is a program, again, that is being used other places that will create this opportunity to deploy in excess of $200 million over about a three-year period of private sector capital in the rural areas so that folks can invest in growing their businesses and hopefully starting new businesses. And this will be a program that works hand-in-hand with local community banks, economic development corporations, chambers of commerce, anyone who might be engaged with their local business community and be, you know, seeking to help them expand and grow their businesses. And so, you know, this is not a government-driven deal, although it will, it certainly the government will oversee this, as it will fall under the governor's economic development and tourism part of his office. But that's just basically to set kind of the framework for how it works. And after that, it's government get out of the way and let the private sector work, and particularly in this case, let's invest in rural Texas.
Yeah, so Chris Patty here with us on the program. $200 million over three, it is House Bill 1000. Was that intentional, or is that just where it landed?
We requested that, and so you know, sometimes you can hit it on the mark, sometimes you can't. We were certainly excited about getting a good round number on there, and we're excited about
that's a pretty good round number.
Yeah, 1,000. Yeah. So I hope that you know, my goal is when this session is over, that we could look back, and certainly in 2 or 3 years from now, particularly to look back and say, you know what, there was that $200+ million worth of private sector capital deployed to rural areas, and we can point to specific job numbers that were created as a result of that. And in fact, it's guaranteed in this particular legislation, because if the numbers are not met, if that full amount is not invested in that amount of time, if the job numbers that are supposed to be associated with those with the economic development plans, if those are not met, then the tax credits are not received. So, there's skin in the game, both for the individual person. Just by way of example, Jay, say you're a local business or a small manufacturing, and you name it, Texas, Levelland, Texas, and you got you want to do a $5 million expansion that will create, say, 70 jobs in the community, which would be huge for any small rural community, be huge anywhere, but particularly in small rural communities. And say of that $5 million, the business themselves, the owner could put in $500,000. Maybe they can go to their local community bank and get another $2.5 million, but that leaves them $2 million short. And that's where a program like this would step in and provide that additional $2 million worth of capital that allows for an ultimately a $5 million expansion that created 70 good-paying jobs in a rural community.
Yeah, so that's no small thing. That would become maybe the primary employer in a lot of rural communities, 70 jobs. So talk to us a little bit about what the $200 million over the course of 3 years, when does that begin, if passed out of the House and the Senate and signed by the governor, when would that $200 million, where does that come from exactly, just for people who aren't familiar with state government, where does $200 million come from, and when would the 3 years start?
Right. Well, as soon as we get it passed, it would start relatively quickly, and it's really important for people to understand, unlike some other incentive programs that we talk a lot about down here in Austin, this is not taxpayer dollars that is going to happen. What happens, you essentially have the equivalent of private equity firms out there that are willing to make investments that are good investments that they can realize a decent return on. That's where this works. It's private sector capital that's raised, it can be raised all over the place. It can be raised around the country. However, it can only be spent in Texas. And so, likely how this would go, this is not a situation where maybe you have a small business there in your community that they would apply to the governor's office for this. It's not like that, which is how some of the other programs are. This would be a situation where maybe they're working with their local EDC, Economic Development Corporation, maybe their Chamber of Commerce, or maybe their local bank. They're working on and they're saying, man, I've got what I think is a good business plan here for a new business, or, hey, we really think that, because of the changing marketing conditions, that we really need to invest in some additional equipment or on-the-job training, workforce development, whatever the case may be. A lot of the referrals through this program are going to come from your economic development corporations, could be a veterans association, it could be a chamber, it could be a bank, and they're going to put the deal together, basically. And so a lot of times it will be your local banker that's going to know that there's another tool over here in the tool shed that is this pool of funds. out there. And so so that's how it'll work. At that point, if they've identified, you know, said business in your community, that fund will go to the governor's office, to that economic development office, and basically apply to do one, create one of these funds. And if approved, it's basically a rural opportunity growth fund that they have, that they could then raise capital. They go get investors, again, just like kind of like private equity situations that you see throughout our state and country. But it's specific to that particular industry based on a certain return on investment. A third-party economist would establish, okay, if you do this, it should create 50 jobs. You know, so the funds themselves, they don't, or even the business themselves, doesn't say, hey, if you give me this money, it will create 50 jobs. There's actually a third party that will analyze that and determine what is that target number. So once that is approved, then that capital can be deployed with the proper metrics. And again, at that point, once those numbers are met, once those 50 jobs happen, once the full amount of money that's supposed to be given is given, then at that point, the tax credits can be earned by that fund.
Yeah.
And so that's that, and again, it's basically offering those tax credits as an incentive for these folks that would put together this private sector capital to invest in rural areas. And the way it's broken down is it has to be in rural areas, which in our bill is defined by any city less than 50,000 or any county less than 200,000 population. And so that's how we, for purposes of this bill right now, that's how we define rural. Now, additionally, you notice that opportunity zone is also in this, because opportunity zones are something that they're all over the state, and that is a federal designation. But an opportunity zone could be in Dallas or anywhere else. And so we did want to provide some opportunity for opportunity zones, which are generally more depressed areas of communities that could really use some investment. But the way we have it carved out is that 85% of these dollars must go into rural communities. The other 15% theoretically could go into an opportunity zone that might be in a Dallas or a Houston or somewhere like that.
Is the legislative stroke behind that you get some urban votes in opportunity zones?
Yeah, you know, certainly we want to do that. I'll be honest with you. We often do things like that here because we know, is that you certainly know this as well, and your listeners, that, you know, rural parts of the state, you know, I, just like me, I'm one vote for six counties in East Texas. You go to Harris County and there's 40 plus members, you know, in the greater Houston area. So, you know, we're outvoted. And so we have to find ways to build coalitions and get people to be willing to take up our cause with us. And so, you know, it's very intentional that we would put that in there to recognize, first of all, it may be really good policy as well, because, you know, investing in opportunity zones or economically disadvantaged areas, it could be could really benefit from this type of infusion of capital. Yeah. That's a good thing too. And what's good for, you know, those areas is good for the state, and I'm all for that.
I see what you did there, Chairman. I see what you did there. So tell me, who is the opposition here? Do you have formal opposition on this bill?
You know, none that really has come to us yet on it. You know, over on the Senate side, Chairman Kelly Hancock is going to carry it over there. Excited to work with him. He and I have several other things working on as well. You know, I think really the only people that I might hear anything from is that, as you well know from following the legislature, I have colleagues and we have members in the legislature who just don't believe in incentives really at all. Whether you're talking about 312 and 313 agreements, or you're talking about the governor's enterprise fund or any of those things, they just flat out just don't really believe that we ought to be offering incentives that you know, these businesses will come anyway. I don't subscribe to that train of thought. Obviously, I do think that incentives are not everything, but they are part of an overall package that gets
worked.
People right, yeah. Absolutely. And so you have to be able to do those things, and I want local communities to have as many tools as possible to make sure that they can be successful. You know, not all of us want to live in Dallas or Houston or Austin or San Antonio. Those are fine places to visit, but they're not home. You know, when I think about people like me who have, you know, two young boys, 17 and 14, and you know, a lot of folks that in my community share the same thought of, you know, that's sure what like if they choose to, like the fact that maybe my kids could choose to live in East Texas as well and make a good living. And the only way we do that is to be able to spur investment and economic development in rural communities, which we can do. But, you know, I'd like for my kids, if they want to live in East Texas, to have that opportunity and not feel like they have to move off to Dallas or Houston or Austin or somewhere like that to make a living, support their family.
Yeah, Senator Kelly Hancock is the chairman of Senate Business and Commerce Committee. No small name there. As this rolls along, we want you to come back on the program. Again, it helps me stop grinding my gears on what are we doing about rural Texas, what are we doing? Because we're all looking at school finance and saying these are, again, the lifeblood, but there has to be some other solutions. I applaud you for putting that forward, Chairman.
Yeah, well, I appreciate it, Jay, and I look forward to talking to you. Anytime you got a question, we'll have a few things going on down here under this pink dome, and so if ever you deem me worthy to come back on, I welcome the opportunity.
All right. We will have you back on. Appreciate you, Chris Patty.
All right. Thank you, Jay. Have a good
All right, buddy. We'll talk to you again soon.
All right.
Chris Patty there. Wes Rappaport reports coming up. What were the numbers there last night? How many numbers did Trump have come out? And how many numbers did Beto O'Rourke? It is the staging of 2020. Get Wes Rappaport on here quickly. And he's in transit. Hopefully he's near Fredericksburg. Hopefully he doesn't stop and get some German food. He makes his call in. Get with Wes Rappaport, fingers crossed, coming up on the other side. He is a media phenom, Wes Rappaport, Rappaport Reports. You can see him locally in Lubbock on KMAC and KLBK. See him throughout the state with Nexstar Communications. He covered what was going down at the border last night. Wes Rappaport, how you doing, buddy?
Hey, Jay. Doing well. How are you?
I kind of like you as a weekly staple here.
Yeah, this is fun. Another terrific Tuesday.
Yeah, we'll just start hashtagging it, Terrific Tuesday. Kind of making a name for yourself here. So, last night, did you cover both events or just one event?
I was at the Donald Trump rally, but we did have crews at both events.
Okay, so tell me this. This is a big question right now. The president tweeting today that hundreds of people showed up for the Beto O'Rourke rally. Is that number wrong? Is it hundreds, like as in like thousands, like a couple hundred? Or
I didn't obviously see the O'Rourke rally with my own two eyes, but from the estimates that I did see, it seemed like it was you know, somewhere in the like 7,000 to 12,000 range. And I'm giving you a broad range because I don't have solid numbers, but the estimate seemed to be somewhere between 7,000 and 12,000.
How many people were at the president's venue?
Well, the venue itself holds 6,500, and then you add probably 1,000 to 2,000 people on the floor, plus. You know, I'll give you a couple of thousand more outside. So they are roughly the same size crowd at both events, plus or minus a few grand. But.
Was this Beto O'Rourke saying anything you can do, I can do better? Is this presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke? Forget the merits. Forget the politics of it. It's all perception is context. Was this Beto O'Rourke saying, I can outdraw you?
Well, I don't know. And But to answer that, I think you have to look at two things. First of all, this thing was being set up like it was a presidential announcement. I mean, they built a stage. It was this whole, you know, promoting it like here's this and promoting it in a way where he's not just going to come out and say, I'm running, you know, I want to get everybody together for a rally because I'm running for president kind of thing. Right. It was a very Beto O'Rourke style, you know, setup, which was the, you know, come out and see what might happen tonight, right? Mm. And I want to march and you never know. And so I think there were a lot of people that thought that he was going to do it. But then he didn't. And so does this lay the groundwork for that? Maybe. Does this, also say maybe he's not going to do it and he's just really trying to be the best, you know, kind of representative for the El Paso community that he can be and kind of, rival the president in that way, you know, say, okay, you want to get all the GOP folks together? We're going to get everybody else together and make some magic or whatever, yeah. However you want to describe it, right? So I don't know. I mean, I think it in a lot of ways it does lay the groundwork, but maybe there are, you know, there are obvious ways where maybe he's just not going to do it and he just wants to, you know, be his hometown guy.
Yeah, but Wes, if the metrics are you drew this many people, I drew this many people, what I just heard you break down is that if Beto O'Rourke didn't match the president, he certainly wasn't very far away from outmatching the president.
Well, he certainly is popular in his hometown, and he certainly has the draw in Texas that we've known that for a long time, and he's got the nationwide popularity as well. Which is why he got a ton of coverage yesterday. You know, so it's not. So I think that he by having this, you know, by participating in this march and this rally, he's feeding the hometown crowd. But I think he's also, acting as a thorn in the president's side, as only Beto O'Rourke could do.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that's intentional or not, you know. I'm not a political consultant, but I don't think it was an accident.
But you can play one on the radio. I do it all the time. You think he's running, Wes?
You know, I sort of had this inkling that he was going to do it last night. And the fact that he didn't kind of has me a little perplexed. But at the same time, I can understand the let's build this up and let's see, you know, maybe this is, again, this is that laying that groundwork and maybe it's, you know, let's have our own announcement, you know, let's do it Beto O'Rourke style with a strong Facebook presence and a rally he can call his own. You know, remember this march and this rally, he did not initiate. This was initiated by other local groups that sort of, he became a participant. And people obviously wanted to come out and see him. So everyone was sort of calling it the Beto O'Rourke rally, but it was really put on by these other local groups that he joined on.
Yeah, Claudia is saying on the text line that I'm pro Beto. I'm not, national politics, Wes, make my head hurt and sometimes my soul. Because I think we get so far away from what's important. We begin to look at things through a national lens. And that's not the lens through which it was intended to be viewed. But I'm only looking at, in talking with Wes Rappaport right now, about the optics. And it was a pretty staunch contrast. Now, I think it's a bad issue for Beto O'Rourke. I will say that a nation has to have walls. It has to have boundaries. Who's in,
yeah.
who's out. You know, and I think that this inclusivity, and I've talked with Beto O'Rourke about this face-to-face, and it was on the show, you know, an interview we did with him for 35 minutes about, isn't the real issue with the wall inclusivity in a party that wants to include everybody? But, you know, sometimes we're known more by what we disallow than what we allow. But I think it's a bad issue, Claudia, on its face. But I think the real story last night was, here's Beto versus Donald Trump. Let's see how it goes. And, Wes, you're telling me, what I gather from this interview is that they drew about the same amount of numbers.
Yeah, I mean, and I mean, if you just think about the issues themselves, I mean, we were talking about how we were going to cover, after both rallies ended, we were talking about, okay, what's the next, what's the follow here, right? And you know, Beto O'Rourke didn't run for president, and Donald Trump didn't make any new news. You know, he didn't break anything. He didn't say anything that we didn't already know. He didn't, change his mind on anything. He pushed his same agenda, and so he didn't change anyone else's mind either. I think he didn't preach to any new choirs last night. So you know, it was hard to. I think that's why people are you know, maybe a little hung up on some of the numbers, because that's the comparable thing. That's the thing you can easily compare. But really, this was Donald Trump coming out to the, you know, to the district that he criticized in his State of the Union address, and to see, I think in a lot of ways, just to see what kind of support he has out in that area, right? And I was surprised to see the numbers of you know, just supporters. Many of them were from El Paso, and we talked to a lot of them, but many of them were from other places. You know, a lot of folks from New Mexico that came down that wanted to see. And so I think there's this kind of other conversation that, you know, that it may be for another day, but about the support, the New Mexico support. And, you know, New Mexico is unquestionably blue right now, but there are a lot of Republicans who feel kind of left out and feel underrepresented and feel, unappreciated. Then they said, you know, I wanted to come down. We talked to a woman whose husband was a furloughed, I think it was at the Department of Justice, maybe, or Border Patrol. I can't remember off the top of my head here, but her husband was a furloughed federal worker. And she said, shut the government down again if you have to. I went out and went to the grocery store today, you know, before I came down here yesterday, and I got everything that I needed as a backup, just in case my husband's paycheck doesn't come in again. You know, so there will always be kind of the devil's advocate, so to speak, whether it's a devil's advocate one way or on the other side.
Yeah.
You know,
that's putting your money where your mouth is too.
It is.
Yeah.
It really
yeah.
is. And so there was a lot of that, you know, I think you kind of expect to hear undertones of it, but it was right in her face. Like, this, there are a lot of people in this room that are supportive, and here we are in El Paso, Texas, you know?
Wes Rappaport, Nexstar Communications, with us on the program. Did you see what's gone viral today? Did you see the assault of, I call it an assault, but did you see crowds? Well, let me just start with this question. Are you nervous walking into a Trump rally with your camera?
So, a lot of points here. Let's unpack it all here. I've covered Trump rallies before, both official events and campaign events,
mm-hmm.
And have always felt a level of protection afforded to anybody in there, right? I feel like it's a generally safe atmosphere. You know, there's obviously this criticism of the press that the president and many of his supporters have, and you know, there's always there's the boos and there's the attention, and you know, we put up with that. That's nothing new, and I'm used to that. But this event felt a little bit different, obviously, with the specific assault that you mentioned. And if the BBC is going to call it an assault, I think I'll go with that, because you know, their camera operator was you know, harassed physically, and equipment as well. And so, you know, so our gear was just, you know, 3-5 feet to the right of all of this. And if this guy had gone, he went left. If he had gone right, he would have had, you know, it would have been a different story. We would have been much more involved. So yeah, it was a, I do generally feel safe at these events. They're anytime the Secret Service is involved, you know, you're the level of, and it's the president. You know, you're not, mm-hmm. they're not going to put him in a room where it's not safe to be. But this time there were all, when we were in Houston for the rally, right before the election with Ted Cruz and everybody else, there were a couple of interruptions. One, two, that was about it. This time there were 3, 4, 5 interruptions, you know, protesters unfurling banners, people yelling, the whole nine yards. It just kind of felt like an unusual, there was just something unusual about this one that was a little bit different. And I don't know what to attribute that to necessarily, but just putting it all out there, I think.
Yeah. So, do you carry?
I don't carry. Yet.
If you yet. Yet. But
I mean, I've got all kinds of camera equipment, and so I don't really have time to go down that road right now.
Yeah.
I've got a job to do, and I figure, you know, especially being in Texas, that there likely is someone around me who is. So.
Yeah. Tell us what you're working on, Wes.
Well, today we followed up a little bit on, we did a little bit of fact checking on both of the rallies, and we were talking about, so the president had kind of rallied off a few of the statistics that he was using to justify building a border wall along the southern border, and we went through some of that data and asked immigration and customs enforcement. We called up ICE and said, "Hey, he said all this yesterday. Can you confirm any of this information is accurate? And if not, what is the information?"
Yeah, what'd they
say? So, you know. And they said that the data was correct, they broke it down for us, and they said, and you know, not to say that the president, you know, would intentionally throw inaccurate information, but there has been misinformation reported from state leaders and the president in the past about the statistics surrounding El Paso. So we wanted to just kind of vet some of that for ourselves independently, and then we also checked in with some of the information that Beto O'Rourke had said, talking about basically kind of comparing his point of view on violent crime in El Paso and saying, okay, well, so he says that the violent crime numbers are kind of unaffected by this and by the wall, and we wanted to vet everything. So basically both of them are right to a certain degree. Talking about people who commit crimes in who are in the country illegally versus people who are American born citizens who commit crimes. So what's the crime rate? Things like that. So they're both right in a lot of ways, and so I think that we wanted to kind of just go in and verify some of that information, because you hear people start rifling off numbers and making claims, and so we did a little bit of fact checking today, and it seemed like most of what we heard last night was suitable.
Both right, which if I'm hearing you correctly, Wes sets up quite a 2020 contest between
these two gentlemen.
Yeah. All right.
If, you know, there's lots of options out there on the table, and we want to make sure that they're being truthful along the way.
He's Wes Rappaport. We get a lot of feedback here on the program. People love hearing from you, Wes. He's at Wes Rapp, R-A-P. There,
well, I'll tell my mom to stop calling then.
Okay. Well, hey, false pride's the same thing as pride, buddy. Appreciate you making time.
Hey, thank you as always.
You're driving back from the border, right?
We're driving back. Yeah, it was a long day, but we were reporting from the road today.
Appreciate you making time, bud.
Thanks, Jay.
Wes Rappaport there, at Wes Rapp on Twitter. Get into a quickie break here and get back in with you. Close out the program. Tell you what's going on, maybe at the Lease in Ponderosa and otherwise, right here on the other side of Texas. Never cast one down. Neither the day brought you home, you were bound to be a star. Just wish you didn't grow so quick. Perhaps I left so far. Gonna go home. Got to get home because I have our first round of fifth grade basketball tonight. Fifth and sixth grade basketball. My daughter is her mother's height about this time, and my wife is tall, and we're looking forward to watching little Gracie Bird play some ball tonight. Always interesting to see how. My daughter has some of my wit and a lot of her mother's competitive spirit, which isn't real high. You know, I sit down and play Scrabble with my wife, and it's like the USSR and America with nukes pointed at each other, only she wants to play like pixie sticks against nukes, and I can't get her to be as competitive as I am. Waiting to see if Grace has a little bit of fire in the engines tonight. They're playing for the Huskies as we go out for our first game tonight. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to have Ross Ramsey, executive editor of the Texas Tribune. And then my friend, the dentist, the acclaimed dentist, Jason White. You hear his ads on the program. Jason White has done so well for himself that he doesn't have to care what other people think. And get him in to talk about, here's the deal. That's his big thing. Here's the deal. He wants to get into some national stuff, which makes me a little bit nervous because I don't like the national stuff. But we're going to get into some national stuff here from a West Texas conservative tomorrow at the end of the program. But for now, gonna get home, gotta get home. Great family, great basketball waiting for me there at the Ponderosa. Until next time, buddies, roll rave on. Not roll long. We roll long at the beginning of the program. Rave on. Rave on, buddies. Keep on saying what needs to be said. We'll see you next time right here on the other side of Texas. Rubbernecking all the outlaws, it's who we want to be. Belly up and just fake it, and two-step overrated. Emily Jones for ABC Bank. Life is a hustle. As a busy mom, wife, and sportscaster, there is never an extra minute in the day. I rely on ABC Bank to have my back. They have the tools I need to get my banking done on the go. I like my banking simple and honest, and they take the hassle out of the hustle. Bank on better with ABC Bank. Member FDIC, an equal housing lender. The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.